And welcome to another episode of We Are EMS Educators Educator Podcast. I'm Dan Limmer with my co-host, Chuck Elias. And we are here very happy to have Jeff Anderson from Bossier Parish Community College. He's the program director there. Educators may know him as the creator and guru behind the Paramedic Educator Google group, which you should reach out to him to get on if you're not already. And today's topic on clinical judgment is very relevant for a number of reasons, but to continue Jeff's bio, he's part of the group that's been doing seminars around the country, spreading the word about the National Registry scenarios and the clinical judgment that's required to go in them. So welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
It's great to be with you again, Chuck.
Great to be here too, Dan. Welcome, Jeff.
Let's get this rolling. So why don't you, I think a great way to start, I mean, I think there's several silos here that we could talk about. Everyone's thinking about the National Registry now. This podcast is going to come out. People are going to be attuned to this. The National Registry has said people aren't teaching in depth enough to handle some of these questions. Clinical judgment's part of it. Let's talk broad stroke about clinical judgment and then kind of transition into how this applies to the classroom and National Registry. How's that?
Sounds great. So for me, this starts back when I was in paramedic school, and we were taught a lot of stuff, but we weren't necessarily taught how to put it all together and how to apply it. And that, to me, that's where the clinical judgment piece comes in. It's not just knowing the facts. It's being able to use them to take care of a patient and to make decisions. And, you know, when I started, I've been a paramedic 23 years now. It was almost like you were told you weren't allowed to come to a conclusion about things. You couldn't diagnose because that's what the doctors did. And, you know, and so it was very confusing to try to figure out, well, how do I put all this together? How do I make decisions about what to do? But then I don't actually decide what's wrong with the patient. And it was all kind of weird. And so I'm really glad we're talking about this now. This journey for me actually began probably about 12 years ago in my paramedic program. I was trying to figure out, how do I teach them to how to actually use the information that I'm presenting to them? And so I started studying clinical decision making and, you know, emergency medicine. There's been a lot of people that have spent time on this and published on it. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, they published the article from the people at the registry about clinical judgment, kind of tying all that together. And so I'm really glad to see us being part of this conversation, because in medicine, they have the Society for Diagnosis and Medicine. They've been around for 10 years or so. They've been pushing this in all healthcare fields. I actually did a course with them a couple of years ago about diagnosis and clinical judgment and decision making and everything. And the course had PAs, nurse practitioners, nurses, physicians. So we're all talking about this. And so I'm glad that we're joining a conversation that's happening in the broader healthcare arena. And we're doing some of the same things as our nursing colleagues and others, so that we can all be working on how to do this better. And I think it's bearing fruit, because on the education side, you know, we're talking about how to train better providers. But on the education side, one of the things we know for sure is that the deeper you process information, the better off you are to remember it later and to be able to use it. And so not only does this make better providers, if we spend more time teaching them how the information's used and processing it more deeply, they're going to do better on the test, they're going to do better in the field internship, and then they're going to do better on registry, and they're going to be better clinicians in the field. So this benefits us in every area of EMS education, talking more about clinical judgment and how we use the information that we have.
Jeff, is this just used for the ALS level at the AMT and paramedic level, or can educators use this at the EMT or EMR level?
I would absolutely. We're implementing some of this stuff in our EMT right now. You know, we use Dan's book for our EMT classes, and there's a good chapter on that in there. But we're supplementing it now with some of the specific things from the model that the registry published. We're using the model a lot more explicitly. Like, one of the things I'm doing with EMT that we'll do for paramedic also, it's just we're revising EMT right now, is I've taken the model that we can link to, I assume, in the show notes. But the model has the wheel on it that talks about how we process the information. Well, I've made a slide deck that I'm going to use for the assessment chapters. And then, so for every piece of assessment, every technique, We're going to talk about not only how do you do it, but then how do you interpret the information using that little framework that the registry gave us. And then again, trying to beef things up. So it's not just about remembering what's on a skill sheet or the primary and secondary. It's about how am I going to interpret this data as I gather it and then apply it to what I'm going to do with my patients. So we don't do EMR in my program. I would assume you could use this in EMR also, but we're definitely going to use it in EMT.
Yeah, definitely use it within that scope. Now, what's interesting is the clinical judgment scenario questions won't be on the EMT. The registry says that that's really not in the scope. In the new scope document, that clinical judgment was AEMT and paramedic. But I really do agree with you that even just to make EMTs pass better and to go out and be more functional, knowing that why and putting that together, I think would be really powerful. What kind of techniques do you use in the classroom? Obviously, this doesn't strike me as the kind of things that come from watching slides, that there's got to be some other stuff involved in this. What kind of things are you doing or would you advise someone to do to get this clinical judgment moving in the classroom?
Well, there's a lot of different things. I think for me, the first thing that I've been trying to do, and this is easier said than done, obviously, is I've been reevaluating how I present the content and trying to make it much more about how the information is going to be used, as opposed to just starting at the top of a list and working my way to the bottom of a list. And so that leads to one of my favorite things ever is the concept of schemas. In psychology, a schema is basically just a collection of information that's chunked up in usable pieces. And then when you put it together, when you need that information, you can draw it all up together and it doesn't tax your memory so much as if you're trying to pull in disparate pieces of information. And so I've tried to use a lot more schemas in the way I teach. And like in my medical course, for instance, I do medical and cardiology are my two big courses in our program. We spend a lot of time talking about chief complaints as opposed to body systems. And so like one of my favorite schemas that I got from somebody else, there's a resource out there called the Calgary Black Book. I tell everybody about this because it's one of the coolest things ever. The University of Calgary Medical School has divided about 150 chief complaints up into these schemas. And so one of my favorite schemas in the book is syncope. So we start with talking about what syncope is and then, you know, how it relates to seizures and sudden cardiac death, how you always need to be thinking about those three things together when you go on a call, because you never know with dispatch what you're actually going to get to. And then we talk about how you work up a patient with syncope and how you try to figure out what's going on. And so headaches, chest pain, respiratory distress, I think starting with chief complaints and then teaching them how the information relates and then explaining how I would use it in the field. You know, I still work in the field. And so I want them to understand how I'm approaching this as someone who's got a fair amount of experience. And then, so I think that's helped a lot. We do a clinical judgment workshop in our paramedic program. We haven't started that with EMT yet, but I came up with this years ago, and I've had to revise it a little bit based on what the registry's released, but just trying to be more explicit about teaching them how they think and how they make decisions and giving them strategies to help do that better, and then plugging in the content to that framework. But the funny thing is I do use slides a lot of times because I have PowerPoint cases that we'll go through in class so that we can have that conversation, you know, with everybody. Because one of the limitations that I find with lab, number one, I'm not as great at simulation as I know some of our peers are. But you're dealing this one at a time, and it's very time intensive. Whereas if we can run through a case together in class, we can have a discussion all together, and I can hopefully, you know, help everybody at the same time. So I think, you know, all of that together helps.
With those discussions, Jeff, you're just not the one who's spoon feeding the information or regurgitating the information to the students. You're sort of setting them up with an example, with a scenario, and then are you guiding them through that, or how are you exactly developing that with the students through the lab session?
Well, it depends on where they are in their journey, because, you know, it's all about the concept of scaffolding. So initially, I'm doing more of the work, I'm doing more of the explaining, and then as we go along, I'm standing back a little bit more and I'm asking more of them. And I'm a big believer in the individual whiteboards too. So I try to ask questions that everybody has to answer, not just one person. And so we're trying to extract more and more information out of them. And then I encourage them to bring in what they've seen before, because the beauty of teaching paramedics is they've all got some EMS experience, most for the most part. So, you know, what have you seen before? What are your partners doing in these scenarios? Things like that. So, you know, as we get further along, it's less and less me and more them. But a lot of it too is just the kind of questions you ask. You know, are you asking the deeper questions, trying to get them to justify why they believe what they believe and why you chose this? Because they hate being asked why. You know, they want to just give you the answer and then be done with it. But when you start asking follow-up questions, it gets a little uncomfortable, but that's where the learning happens.
Now, with your individualized whiteboards, do they actually bring in a little whiteboard and you have them write the answers down, or how do you incorporate that?
I have a crate of them. I just bought some. You know, they're actually pretty cheap on Amazon. So I got some socks for erasers, some dry erase markers out of our pantry in our downstairs, and then I bought the whiteboards. And so you know, we can do dosage calc with them. We can do multiple choice answers. My partner is really good at using Kahoot. I've not really sat down to figure that out yet, but my partner Allison, she's an expert at that, and they have a ton of fun with that too.
Yeah, and slides themselves, just to go back, are not evil. It's the way sometimes we use them. And you're right, cases, you know, putting up, you know, probing questions that students can work on in groups and look up at the screen and see what's there. There certainly are, you know, good things that are there. You want to get into the clinical judgment model a little bit more, that wheel and the article, and to talk a little bit more about that concept?
Sure. So the model is basically, they've proposed this model, which I think is really good. And I believe a lot of it came from nursing, some of the things they've been doing also, because this journey that we're doing with testing, the nursing profession has also been going down a little bit ahead of us. It was originally just about, you know, how can we test clinical judgment? How can we define it? Because you can't really test something unless you can define what it is. And I really like using it for teaching too. We've been thinking about how we do things a lot more compared to the model. So the model covers an entire call. It's not just you know, like individual pieces of a call. It's all together. So there's leadership that happens on the call. There's communication that happens on the call. But then individually, they've divided up into phases. So you've got the pre-scene phase, the scene phase, and the post-scene phase. And so you have different things that are happening in those phases. And so when the registry is writing questions for this, they actually have questions that they have. There's a little bit of a vignette about the pre-scene, and they'll have questions about that. They'll have a vignette about the scene, and then there'll be questions about that. And then there'll be the post scene. They'll have questions about that. So thinking about, you know, how you're responding to a call versus what you do on the scene. And then to me, the most important part though, is just this concept of cues, where any piece of information that you're given during the call, you would process using this tool that they've created. And then you gain information from that, and then you move on. So it starts with just recognizing that there is a cue that has happened. There's a piece of information that you need to do something with. And what I love about that is just it gives us a way to focus on that with the students, because a lot of times they don't see the important stuff. And that's just the difference between a novice and an expert, is knowing what to look for and knowing what's significant and not significant. You know, we get a ton of information thrown at us on a call. How do we decide what's important? And so that's part of the conversation we can have then is, okay, I told you these 10 things. You thought that these things were important, but actually this is the most important, or you were right, that's the most important. Those are the conversations you can have about just recognizing the cues and what's important. And then you analyze the cue so that you decide whether it's relevant or not. So like if the cue is a pulse ox reading, then part of your analysis is, can I trust this pulse ox reading? Is it correct? Is the skin well perfused? The fingers well perfused? Is the, you know, the light on? Does the heart rate match the pulse ox heart rate? Is the plethysmograph waveform nice? I mean, all of these things you would do to assess whether or not you're getting a good answer, good information or not. And then, you know, in Louisiana, every now and then we get some carbon monoxide poisoning because our air conditioning goes out and someone puts a generator next to their window. So, you know, is the scenario tell me that maybe the pulse ox isn't accurate? And then you define a hypothesis, and this one always gets a little bit of pushback because, you know, why are we hypothesizing about what's wrong with the patient? But I mean, realistically, that's how you do critical thinking, is you analyze information, you come to a conclusion about what you think is relevant about it, your hypothesis, and then you generate solutions for how you're going to handle that. If a solution is necessary, sometimes the answer is, I'm not dealing with this right now, we're going to move on to something more important, and then come back. Then you take action, which is, I think, is vital too, because in EMS, we move fast, and everything we do has to lead to action. It has to lead to us making decisions and moving the patient forward. And then we evaluate our actions, because, you know, we generate information as we take actions and treat the patients. Now we got to repeat the process. Now that I have a patient that's already received this therapy, or I've done this thing, what do I do now? Do I keep continuing down the path I was on? Do I need to adjust my path because now that I've done this thing, I see a different patient, or the patient's changed, I guess would be a better way to say it. And so it's just this constant process. And I love how they represent this as a wheel that just, it never ends. You're going to make, you know, hundreds of decisions on a call, and you're just going to keep going until the call's over.
And we will put that in the show notes in case anyone hasn't seen that article. It has been out there pretty widely, but we'll put that in the show notes. I'll also say that that black book from Calgary, if you just Google that, that's free.
Yep.
I was amazed. I got this called up on my screen here, and someone not having that would seem kind of silly. So that black book is a PDF download, and it's free. That's a great reference. People listening, that's a bonus just for listening to this, is to have that resource for people.
Yeah, every time I talk about that, I've talked about it in several conference talks, and we talk about it in the workshop, and everybody gets excited about it, because I don't know how I found it, to be honest. I've had it for so long. I think they're on the 10th edition now, and I've been using it since like the 6th, yeah. But they revise it. It's just great.
I'm excited. I totally get it. All right, let me take you in a little bit of a rabbit hole. Obviously, the National Registry is doing away with the psychomotor exam, or has done away when people are listening to this. And part of these things, you talk about doing something and evaluating and weighing what's important. A lot of the things people would do in a psychomotor exam. How do you feel about the psychomotor exam going, and how does this fit in there? I'm sure it's a question you get occasionally in those presentations you do, maybe occasionally.
Yeah. The funny thing to me is, for the most part, paramedic educators are ready for this to be done.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. I think, you know, the reasons the registry stopped doing it, I think, are good reasons. To take it a step back, for me, where I start with all of this is, I really think it's vitally important that if you're a program director or program faculty, but especially program director, that you structure the end of your program, the summative assessments, to where you know that they're competent before you clear them with registry to test. So I personally believe very strongly that your process at the end should be harder than whatever you think the registry is. And again, deciding how hard the registry actually is kind of not, there's not a lot of fruit to think about that, but just whatever your version of entry-level competence is, try to take them a bit past that and make sure that when they're done, you know they're ready. So this idea that the registry is going to sort out who's ready and is not, I get that that's their purpose, but we should be doing some of that work in the program too. And so so ideally, if you've set your program up right, taking the registry is not that big of a deal. So that's number one for me. Number two is, just if you think about how we actually have been practical testing for years and years, they've always had to make certain compromises to make sure they had reliability and to make sure everybody got the same test. And I don't know, it got to the point where I wasn't feeling like we were doing a really good job testing. And that's not a criticism of the registry. I think it's just a criticism of what we were trying to do. And I don't think it works very well. By the time you make sure everybody gets the same kind of test, and you go through all the exam security stuff, which I know that was a total headache for them for years, you end up with something that I don't think really did a very good job. And so I'm glad to see it's gone. I think we're going to do a much better job in the program. And I think most of the important stuff they were testing, they can do on the computer now. And I think we'll do a better job of it.
Jeff, with that psychomotor test that we were running our students through or preparing them for the registry, a lot of it was almost singular based on in skills, doing isolated skills, which when we're talking about student minimum competencies, we are already setting them up with, let's go ahead and show them how to start an IV, and then we progress it into a scenario, smaller scenario, then to a large scenario, and then to have the registry as the gatekeeper for these students at the very end to say, all right, we're going to go ahead and have them do some of these isolated skills. Almost seems like we went backwards. And it's like, if my thought would be, if they wanted to do this, maybe that should have been a point in halfway through the class, a third of the way through the class, where they can assess how are their psychomotor skills versus at the end, where we're progressing them up to this end point, and all of a sudden we're looking at just these singular skills with testing. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, and I was around when we switched from just the old 12 station test to the portfolio and the shorter test. And so I think they were moving in that direction. Like they introduced the integrated house of hospital scenario, which I loved. But then as we cut along, you start to realize, man, that 20 minutes is a grind. That made the test hurt. And then retesting suffered, because when your exam staff's exhausted from doing all those integrated out of hospital scenarios, and then you can't retest them. And then, so I think you learn as you do. And so I think they definitely made a good step in that direction. And I think the portfolio was a good step too. I'll be honest with you, the coolest thing about the portfolio to me back in 2010, whenever we went through all that, number one, I was really impressed with how the registry rolled that out. I mean, if you were there and you watched all the effort they went through to get that out there, it was impressive. But then number two, the concept of peer-to-peer skill evaluation, I think, was a game changer for me. Because if I've got 10 students in a lab and the only time they're performing a skill is when I'm physically running it, that's not a good use of lab time. And so I think a lot of us started having peer-to-peer and faculty evaluations, and just to change the way we did lab, and it's been all benefit for us. That to me, and I don't know why we needed permission to do that from the registry, but I did. I know I can't speak for anybody else, but I had thought about doing something like that, but I always thought it was like, oh, I can't do that. And then when the registry said it was okay, well, all right, it's okay. The registry said it was okay.
Yes.
Which, again, I shouldn't have needed that, but it did.
What do you say to the instructors that are still out there saying, I can't trust a student, I can't trust Dan to evaluate Chuck, or Chuck to evaluate Dan on these isolated skills? They're going to cheat. They're buddies. They're going to just sign each other off. What do you say, or how do you get those instructors, new instructors, or the older instructors that are set in their ways to come on board to do these things?
Modeling, I think, is the first one. You just show them how you want the labs to run. You do it with them so they can see it. Change is hard for all of us. I know change is hard for me. And so, getting people to adjust how they do things. And we're going down this road with EMT in Louisiana also. Louisiana has an EMT portfolio. And we have a state EMT exam that is modeled after the integrated out-of-hospital scenario. Thankfully, it's not 20 minutes. It's only 10 minutes for the EMTs. But so that's been a little difficult too, because instructors that aren't even teaching paramedics are having to learn this in our state. But I know there's been a lot of debate about whether skill sheets are good or not. I personally still like skill sheets, but we've made our own. We don't use the registry testing sheets for lab, obviously. We have our own. But I think having the students have an instrument in front of them, where what we'll do is I'll have one of them's grading, one of them's running it, and then one of them's performing the skill, and then they just rotate around. And I think the skill sheet does help keep them on task. Now, obviously, I have to be around and have to watch them, and then eventually they are going to have to do the skill for me. And so if they can't do the skill and their buddies have been saying they're good, then we're going to have a conversation with all of them about why. And so there does have to be accountability. You don't get out of work. It just changes the nature of the work a little bit.
Sure.
Yeah. We have to find a balance. You know, back when the flipped classroom was new, people say, well, what happens if they don't do the work outside of class? You know, well, we'll know that they're not doing it because they're not going to thrive. And the same things. I mean, there'll always be the students who will get together and they'll either sign each other off or they'll just be joking around and say, oh, you know, whether it's malicious or not, it really doesn't matter. But at some point when they come to do it before an educator, you're going to know when that doesn't work. But the benefit of doing it and then watching and grading someone is another way of learning. And I do think that we largely are ahead of the game in doing that. Yet I also agree that it is challenging to change our ways and to be able to do that largely because we're EMS people, we're educators, and you know, we look at our influence, realizing we have to mature and realize there's other influences that would make us better. I'm going to just jump into, there's other parts of this new cognitive exam, especially at the paramedic level. The proportions have changed a certain amount, and there's a pretty big preponderance towards medicine, which I'm okay, because that's a lot of what we do. You know, operations and trauma are surprisingly small, although clinical judgment will pull out some of those areas.
Mm-hmm.
The cardiology, they say 30% of the cardiology questions are going to be interpreting ECGs, that they're going to have visual ECGs in there to do. So you're really kind of almost getting that old static station built into the exam. I think that in itself, a lot of people choke on statics and they shouldn't, right? It's one of those skills. So they are moving that stuff in there. And I think all of these questions together have the potential to make the exam a little more challenging.
I agree. Static has always given us trouble too. I cannot understand why we continue to have trouble with static. All my practice decks have cards where you don't actually provide the cardiac treatment. I try to have a 12 lead in all the decks. One of the best things the registry did with static was when they allowed you to get points for treatment, even if you didn't get the rhythm right. That was, I always had a problem with static because of that. Cause I know as a medic, there's times I'm not entirely sure what the rhythm is, but I know what to do based on the patient and whether they're fast or slow or have no pulse. That's kind of where we start. That's what ACLS is built around. So if they misdiagnose a secondary heart block or something like that, I'm less concerned about that than if they don't know how to pace somebody or can't recognize a hemodynamically unstable patient. But I'm glad to see them put EKGs on there, because we read a lot of EKGs. And it's a skill we got to know.
Yeah, it does put it out there. The National Registry, I've talked personally with Bill Seifert and Paul Rosenberger about this, and they say that based on the pilot and based on the experience of the NCLEX and others, by adding a lot of these TEIs, the technology enhanced items, into the test, they say that it doesn't, that they don't believe they're going to take a ding in pass rates. EMS, the National Registry, doesn't give any partial credit for any of the multiple response or any of the TEIs. And what's your take on that? Are we going to find it more difficult? Are we going to see any ding in the pass rates?
I've been thinking about that a lot, because I'm actually also on the ALS redesign committee with the registry. And so I've been part of a lot of those meetings for the last 2 years. By the way, I'm continually amazed at how thoughtful they've been about this. So I guarantee you, Paul and those other people at the registry, they're really thinking about this and looking at it. And one of the people that's over the NCLEX is a former registry guy, former paramedic, nurse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, amazing guy. He's been part of this. I've learned so much from him in these meetings. And he was telling us that the nurses didn't see that much of a drop, if any. And so I hope we're going to be the same. I'm a little worried, because I agree with you. I think this is going to be a little more challenging than it has been. But, you know, I was around when we switched to the adaptive test, and I remember all the hoo-ha about that. And then we actually found, you know, between the last year of all paper and the first year of all adaptive, scores went up. And so I'm hoping that's what's going to happen here. I think the registry has done a very good job of getting the word out. And so I think it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. I know it will be, but it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that this has happened. And another thing I think is going to be very helpful is most of us have learning management systems provided by our schools. And I can't speak for anybody else, because I've only used Canvas for the last 6 or 7 years, but most of those items I can recreate in Canvas. So we've been using a lot of multiple answer items or multiple response items, depending on what your vendor calls them. Love those. I think that's more realistic in a lot of cases, instead of picking the best answer, you know, picking the three that are relevant here. I love that. Ordering items, Canvas will do that. I think that's also really good. So one of the things I think these items do is it makes it more realistic. I mean, multiple choice is good in a lot of scenarios, but then sometimes multiple choice isn't the best way to ask a question. And now that they have these other choices, I think we're going to get a more realistic test. I think the ordering, I think, would be very good also.
I agree. I like to ask myself, I look at some of the questions the National Registry puts out, and I agree with you. I think they have been very transparent. I think they've been, whether it be at conferences or social media or seminars that you're doing, you know, getting it out there, getting the word out. I don't have an issue in the world. They've been very forthright. I've even asked them personal questions as we're developing items and putting them in our products. And without, they're not giving away secrets, but ask about styles or different things. They've been really very forthright about that. I think that EMS education and nursing education, though, is a little bit different. And I think nursing has been around a little bit longer. I think they're a little bit more of a machine as they go, you know, the way they do things in tradition. I do think we're going to have to really up our educational game, you know, with this to be able to get through. And I'm not a gloom and doom person. I don't necessarily know what's going to happen when that switch is flipped. I do know that EMS is very change averse and very freaky about that. And that, I think, is one of the biggest issues we're seeing here. And we take and we transmit our anxieties to our students. We say, oh, this new exam is this. It's not a new exam to them. It's the one they're going to take. It's new to us, right? So we need to get the message out there and consider how we message it to our students.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think there has to be accountability for us as educators. Whenever there is something new or there's changes occurring, we need to be able to demonstrate and relay that information to our students. And we need to be able to be self-reflecting as educators to say, all right, if something's not working, what maybe me as me, the educator, is not getting across to the students, instead of saying, well, Dan is this type of student. He just can't pass it. So that's Dan's fault. And that's not Chuck's fault for this. I mean, I hear that a lot of times where there's really no ownership into what the program's pass rates are. It's always somebody else's fault. It's the registry's fault. It's the state's fault. It's the student's fault. How can we better, as educators, get that point across to the other educators to seek CE, to seek experts that are out there that know what they're talking about, that have gone through workshops, that have looked at the ideas like you have, Jeff, for this clinical reasoning and to progress our profession?
Well, this leads to another of my soapbox issues, I guess. I think one of the issues here, I think this is definitely a multifactorial problem, but I think one of the issues that we have in EMS that's also pretty common in all of higher education is that we take content experts and then we want to make them instructors, which is a good idea. But how we make them into instructors is a problem. And then the second part of that is teaching content and creating content are two different skill sets. And so we don't bring people in and just, here's a class that's already made for you. I just need you to teach this and I'm going to show you how. And then later on, once they've gotten good at that, okay, let me teach you how to make the content that you taught. And so it's just, I think part of the excuse making and everything, which I've done myself, it's self-preservation. It's just like, I have so much to do. A lot of this stuff, I really don't know how to do it. And I'm just trying to survive here. And couple that with the fact that most of us are under-resourced in our programs. We don't have enough help. And so there's a lot there. And so that's one of the reasons I was really excited about these clinical judgment workshops that Registry paid for and NMC kind of put out there, was that we're teaching people how to do some of this. You know, it's very practical stuff. We spend the morning talking about the concepts and the theory. You know, my particular presentation in the morning is very heavy on theory, but then in the afternoon, it's all about the application of it. Here's how you can do this tomorrow in your program. And it's going to take time. You know, creating content's not easy. And Dan, you probably know that more than anybody because that's what you do. And so getting those skills and getting them refined, and then once you really get good at it, it becomes a lot easier, but that's a pretty good learning curve. And so with this, I think that's a big thing, is just if we can empower our educators, give them skills to create their own content and to do what they think they need to do. Because I think most educators are frustrated with their programs in the sense that they want to do more. They have a vision of where they'd like to be, but they don't have the time, the resources, the skills, whatever it is, to actually get there. And if we can give them all that so they can get there, I think it's going to be amazing.
It sounds like we need to do a better job of collaborating as educators instead of staying in our own silos and saying, this is the way that I do things, whether it's good or bad. And I don't really want to work with Jeff or Dan because they might know what I don't know, or that they might think that they're going to get my secrets or things like that.
Well, and that's why I created the Paramedic Faculty Google Group years ago. I stole the idea from the NEMSMA, the National Association of EMS Managers, or I hope I got those letters right. But they have a pretty active Google group that where they help each other out with policies and questions and stuff. And I was like, well, why don't we have that? And so I started it. And the main reason was so I could steal from other people. I'll be perfectly honest. I wanted to take what they were doing awesome and then bring it into my program. And then hopefully I would share something with them too. But the goal was for me to get better.
Yeah, well, a continued plug for that. The thread that's going on right now about the first time site visit and the advice people are giving is really awesome stuff. And there are some really good conversations going on out there. The other thing I'll say is that to Chuck's point or question is that the Accreticon conference and NEMSI are really spots where there's not only sessions that address all of this and more, but the potential for networking is strong. The recent Accreticon conference in Oklahoma City had great enrollment, had a great feel, from the people that were there. And I think that it's a great resource to have, and NEMSI as well. We've got that, May, June to August, really time that summer when educators can go out. Now, it costs money. Not everybody's got that. I understand that. But there's some really good resources out there that I would highly recommend people get, because all of those questions are answered.
And I think one of y'all mentioned silos a little bit ago, and I think that's a big part of this too, is to realize that we're not just EMS education. Other professions are having the same problem. I learn a lot from podcasts and blogs from secondary teachers, other higher ed teachers, so a lot of the concepts of how to teach and learn are not tied to just EMS. And so if you broaden your reach a little bit, the last 20 years or so, there has been a ton of research on learning that's been published and is accessible through cognitive psychology and educational psychology. It's out there and it's all free. And so if you can't go to a conference, you can listen to a podcast or read a blog, or most of the research is open access. You can read the papers themselves. There's a lot out there. There's a lot of books that have been written by cognitive psychologists that specialize in learning that are on Amazon for $15 that'll completely change the way you teach. So there's a lot of information out
there. The emergency medicine resource is out there too.
Oh, yes.
We talk about clinical judgment. I get journal spoon feed every day and MDocs, and we're looking at some of these really great things, Weingart stuff, all these things out there. And when we talk about clinical judgment, I like to look at the SOFA and QSOFA and the Canadian syncope scales. And, while we don't have all the lab tests there, but if I look at those and say, these validated tests look at this part very highly, I need to incorporate that in my education.
Absolutely. Right? Okay,
maybe you don't have the lab values. However, if you believe your syncope is cardiac related, or if they have a history of syncope, we're knocking it down a peg, those things are things that we should be putting in our education for clinical judgment to do that. Even if we can't do the whole thing, the old days, physician stuff is way above us. But now with the decisions that we're making, the judgments we're making, I think some of those physicians' resources combined with those education resources has a lot of power in what we do as well.
Yeah, one of my favorite blogs is Life in the Fast Lane. It's Australia. It's basically an online emergency medicine textbook. It's amazing. There's a service I pay for called MRAP that's also pretty awesome, but it does cost a little bit. But they have a podcast as a part of that family that's called Emergency Medicine Abstracts. So if you want to learn about research, you got two expert researchers that are going through 30 articles a month and explaining what they like about them, what they don't like about them, how this will change your practice. That's probably one of my favorite resources.
It's been out there a long time. That used to be in cassette tapes they mailed to you.
They did.
I mean, I probably shouldn't be saying that, but I was around, then for that. I'll also just a quick plug, and this isn't a paid product, foamfinder.com, Limmer Education does.
Yep.
And if you want to just figure out what's out there on pulmonary embolism, you can just type it in, and it's going to scoop all that stuff for you and put it in one place. I just got a wild hair one day and said, let's create something where we can put that together. So we do have that out there as well.
And we've used that in the program. One of the things I like about the foam world is that part of the discussion you can have with your students is how to put weight on the various resources they find too. Cause you got some people that are on the absolute bleeding edge that's probably not good to be there just yet. But then, there's other resources that are a little bit behind. And so you can talk about, well, here's why we don't do that anymore. It may be giving them too much sometimes, but I like my students to understand why we are where we are right now. And so they can understand why their preceptors hold certain beliefs and why they may get feedback in the hospital about certain things. Like, I'm doing trauma right now, so discussing pain management and abdominal pain is a big thing because you got to have a spectrum of beliefs on this. Spinal immobilization, you know, I did my duty and we put students in KEDs 2 weeks ago. But while we were doing that, we were having a discussion about the Nexus criteria and how we've evolved and why you should probably never put somebody in a KED anymore. And so I think those are valuable.
Yeah, it's a dilemma. I mean, for doing a textbook, working on the next edition of emergency care, do we even put those in anymore? Right? You're probably required to do them. I look at my job as a lead author of the book is, you know, we could not change practice, but if they're not in the book, first of all, it's a risk because somebody's going to say, I'm still required by my state to teach those. Yet, if I take them out, I mean, nobody's got them on the truck anymore. Nobody's using them. 10 years ago, we were spinning people out into a backboard without them, and it was against the rules. Right now, we've got spinal motion restriction. We can do it. And that comes down to judgment, you know, where we are stuck in this weird spot, this public safety healthcare, where public safety makes us do KEDs while healthcare says, yeah, don't do them anymore.
And I miss my standing takedown. I used to love that lab. You know, the lab trust exercise.
That's it. All right, we're at the mark now where we probably will wind down. And we've taken a really enjoyable meandering path through clinical judgment and a lot of the associated things about teaching it and exams and other things that all intertwine. Let's wrap this up with, do we have any last words, anything? You know, what would you say from your presentation and from your seminars that the registry has been putting on? What would you say now as the last word? Right, primacy and recency, got the last thing. Hit them with something that we're going to take home and use.
The biggest lesson to me is just that we have always been expected to do this. We've always been expected to come to conclusions and evaluate information. So that's not exactly new. The registry has given us some tools now to better explain it, to have some language to use. But I think the key thing is the whole purpose behind this is to make EMS education more realistic and more closely aligned to what we do every day in the field. So if that's kind of your goal, if your goal is to prepare somebody to work on the truck and to work with you and do what you do, I think that's the goal. And then if you start there, everything else is going to fall into line. It's an effort. It's absolutely a lot of work, but it's worth it. And it's going to reap very big results in the future.
Not as foreign as we think it is.
Nope, I don't think so at all. It's amazing how many times I've given somebody language for something they've always known as we're covering stuff like this. And so I think, you know, a lot of it's already out there. It's just, we got to bring it up to the front and make it explicit.
All right, Chuck, any last words from you?
Last words I have is just trying to tie everything together. The reason Dan and I started this podcast is to try to help educators find new ideas, latest ideas out there that can help them with their programs, not just about education, with accreditation and all the things alike. So this is the purpose of this podcast, is to try to provide an additional resource out there for the educators so that we can all bring this thing together and elevate all of our programs.
I think it's a great way to finish. And anyone listening, we're very grateful that you're here. And Chuck and I will continue to do this podcast, get some great information out there. Great information like we got from Jeff Anderson today. Jeff, thank you for being here. I think this is great information, and keep going out there and being that voice and doing good things.
Thank you for having me.